The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the National Geographic. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are simply selected for your enjoyment and edification. Well, today on Armchair Traveler, we're going to dive into the undersea world of whales. Secrets of the Whales is the featured article in National Geographic's May 2021 Ocean issue. The writer is Craig Welch. Now, as the editors explain, and here's their quote, "We're learning that some groups of whales and dolphins have their own dialects, diets, and routines, cultural differences once thought to be unique to," guess what? "To humans." Wow. Let's see what we can learn as we dive in, so to speak, no pun intended, of course, dive into this article. John Ford wanted a whale's eye view one summer day in 1978. A pod of killer whales raced toward a pebbled beach on British Columbia's Vancouver Island. The young biologist was waiting in a wetsuit and snorkel. The ghostly black and white procession steamed in like a team of U-boats, low and fast. Ford pressed on his face mask and slipped into the sea. In waters barely 10 feet deep, the creatures slowed and rolled to their sides. Bodies partially submerged, the fans at the end of their tails, their flukes, wagging. The whales began to twist and shimmy. One by one, each scuffed its side and belly on the stones like grizzlies scratching against the pines. Ford, age 66, has now studied killer whales, the largest dolphin, and from the branch of the cetacean order known as tooth whales, for more than 40 years. He's seen this phenomenon, called beach rubbing, countless times since that first underwater glimpse. He can't say for certain why the animals do it. He suspects it's a form of social bonding. A larger question, though, has gnawed at him for much of his career. How come these killer whales or orcas do it, but not their nearly identical neighbors just to the south? Beach rubbing is a routine among this population, called northern residents, because they ply inland seas during summer and fall between the Canadian mainland and Vancouver Island. Not so their neighbors to the south. The orcas around the border with Washington State, where I live, have never been documented performing this ritual. Washington's killer whales, called the southern residents instead, have their own conventions. They hold greeting ceremonies, facing off in tight lines before exploding in underwater parties of rubs and calls. That's exceedingly rare up north. Southern residents are aerialists, performing twisting leaps and belly flops. Northern residents breach far less. Some years the southern residents push dead salmon around with their heads. Not the northerners. They occasionally headbutt one another, bumping noggins like bighorn sheep. They just swim at each other and sort of collide, Ford says. The two populations don't even converse with the same vocabulary. Northern residents emit elongated, shrill, metallic squeals that sound like air escaping balloons. Southern residents add monkey hoots and goose honks. To Ford's practiced ear, the pitches and intonations sound as different as Mandarin and Swahili. Yet, in every other meaningful way, the northern and southern residents are indistinguishable. For months at a time, they occupy adjacent seas. Their ranges overlap. Although many varieties of killer whales exist around the world, the northern and southern whales share almost identical genetics. From the northern Pacific to the seas around Antarctica, killer whales also have varying diets. Some eat sharks, porpoises, penguins, or manta rays. In Patagonia, they launch into rocky shores and pluck seal pups off the beach. In Antarctica, killer whales flush Weddell seals off floating ice, teaming up to swim floes and wash dinner into the drink. But the northern and southern residents are both pescatarians and eat mostly just one species, Chinook salmon. How could two groups from essentially the same place be genetically similar and yet speak and act so differently? For years, Ford and a few colleagues would only whisper that this paradox implied. or what it implied, is it possible that these complex social beings weren't driven solely by the inherited twitch of genetic instinct? Were killer whales passing on unique traits, influenced by more than their environment or DNA? Could whales have their own cultures? The very notion seemed blasphemous. Anthropologists long had considered culture the ability to socially accumulate and transfer knowledge, strictly human affair. But researchers had described how songbirds learn dialects and transmit them across generations, and Ford proposed that killer whales might do the same. Then he started hearing about the findings of biologists studying a creature a world away, the sperm whale. Those scientists had been building the case that some whale species act and communicate differently based on how they're raised. It appeared these cetaceans might carry on diverse traditions, just as some humans eat with chopsticks, while others use forks. Today, many scientists believe some whales and dolphins, like humans, have distinct cultures. Researchers see signs in sperm whales in the Galapagos and the Caribbean, in humpbacks across South Pacific, and Arctic belugas, and in the Pacific Northwest killer whales. The possibility is prompting new thinking about how some marine species evolve. Cultural traditions may help drive genetic shifts, altering what it means to be a whale. But this idea is also reshaping our view of what separates us from these aquatic beasts. Whale culture, it seems, is rattling time-worn conceptions of ourselves. Humans are a narcissistic breed. Throughout history, we've vacillated between seeing animals through the lens of our own behavior and refusing to accept that we're anything alike. This is particularly true of whales. They're often viewed as almost human or not like us at all. We anthropomorphize or insist on our own uniqueness. Neither, of course, is entirely correct. Whales reside in a foreign place we're just coming to understand. It's hard to imagine a home like ours. The deep ocean is a universe we've seen less of than the surface of the moon. There are mountains and rivers, but few borders. Life traverses a vertical plane. It's so dark that sight is of limited value. Entire relationships are forged through sound. And yet, as we spend billions scanning the heavens for alien life, the mysteries we're unraveling beneath the waves reveal foreigners here at home that are more like us than we knew. Whales' alliances, the intricacies of their conversations, and the way they care for their young seem eerily familiar. Some may even openly mourn. In 2018, a southern resident killer whale known as Taliqua pushed the carcass of her newborn, which had died shortly after its birth, around with her snout for 17 days. For years, scientists vigorously avoided using emotional terms like happy, sad, playful, or angry when describing animal behavior, writes Jay Gatos, who oversees a university program in Washington State to protect marine life through science and education. But Gatos and many whale biologists believe Taliqua's behavior was a show of grief. When photographer Brian Scarry first mentioned this interest in exploring the culture of these remarkable animals, one group leaped to mind. I live 4 miles from Puget Sound, where three pods of southern resident killer whales spend a portion of their year zipping about in tight formations like squadrons of Air Force Thunderbirds. When their dorsal fins break the surface near shore, crowds gather with cameras, hoping to catch a memorable hop or acrobatic lunge. What secrets might these whales carry? Could knowing them help us live better together? Scientists have long understood that many whale actions must be picked up from peers or elders. It's learned behavior and hardly shocking. Even Aristotle knew animals learned from one another. Songbirds raised away from their own families utter a different voice from their parents, he wrote. Charles Darwin noted that animal traps eventually must be moved because wild creatures imitate each other's caution. While genes determine the shape and function of a creature's body, encoding instructions for essential traits and behaviors, social learning is received wisdom, the development of neural connections that let animals learn from the knowledge of those around them. Scientists generally agree that culture requires that behaviors be socially learned and shared widely, and that they persist. As groups of animals transmit multiple learned behaviors, they can develop sets of habits wholly distinct from others of their species. For example, the ability to throw is genetic, but throwing a curveball requires social learning, and playing baseball instead of cricket is culture. The danger, though, is to confuse culture with intelligence. Scientists don't all agree on whether intelligence is an essential ingredient for culture. Social learning cuts widely across the animal kingdom, and not just among beings we consider smart: whales, primates, crows, elephants. Bumblebees may choose flowers based on the behavior of experienced bees. Mongooses learn from siblings and cousins to break open eggs or smash beetles. But being smart clearly helps, and cetaceans' capacity for learning captured our imaginations early. For decades, we've packed marine theme parks, applauding killer whales, belugas, or bottlenose dolphins that sing or vault through hoops in giant pools. These feeble attempts to corral their skills barely scratch the surface of their talents. In 1972, a scientist studying a bottlenose dolphin calf named Dolly exhaled cigarette smoke into the window of her enclosure during a break. The observer was astonished when the animal immediately swam off to its mother, returned and released a mouthful of milk which engulfed her head, giving much the same effect as had the cigarette smoke, researchers wrote at the time. Among some whales, intelligence may even be an evolutionary response to culture, as social animals spread learned wisdom far and wide. For culture to exist, individuals must come up with new ways of doing things to get shared among peers, and whales can be shrewd innovators. A few hungry sperm whales, off the coast of Alaska in the late 1990s found new ways to snack. They stripped black cod off commercial fishing boat long lines. Using underwater cameras, scientists recorded a whale delicately grabbing a line with its massive jaw, creating tension, and then sliding its mouth up the strand until the vibrations popped off a fish. The practice, previously rare, quickly spread. In the Gulf of Maine in 1980, one humpback was seen hunting in a new way. Before blowing bubbles around schools of sand lances to disorient them, the whale smacked the surface with its fluke. Humpbacks regularly use the bubble technique, but the fluke slap was new. It's not clear how it helps, but by 2013, scientists counted at least 278 whales that hunted this way. For years, scientists thought animals were incapable of broad, sustained, intergenerational sharing. That notion began changing in 1953. That year, a young Mackay Aimo was spotted on Kashima Island, Japan, washing a sweet potato in a stream. Before then, the island's Mackays simply wiped dirt off their food. Soon, scientists documented Mackays by the dozens washing them instead. Long after Aimo died, Mackays still carted potatoes to shore to dunk them into the sea. Then in 1999, Andrew Whitten, a cognitive scientist with Scotland's University of St. Andrews, published a landmark paper with primate experts, including Jane Goodall. They noted that dozens of chimpanzee traditions, grooming, rain dancing, strutting about at the first signs of precipitation, cracking nuts with hammers, poking termite mounds with sticks, appeared across some chimp communities, but not others. If you watch a chimpanzee long enough and check out these behaviors, you can pretty much tell where the chimp came from, Whitten tells me. And watching people behave is often how we identify human culture. Not everyone is convinced. Some researchers argue that genetic or environmental variables could have prompted some of these behaviors. The chimpanzees weren't all the same subspecies. They ranged from coastal Guinea to Uganda. They ranged from 2,700 miles apart, rather, far enough, some suggest, that ecological differences could have influenced their primates' activities. But a new way of thinking about wildlife behavior and group culture, less centered on humans, was taking root. And as Whitten and others built on their initial work, skeptics found claims harder to dismiss, especially when it came to creatures longer than city buses that use sound to find their prey a mile below the sea's surface. "Whoa, whoa, right here," Shangaro shouts and begins counting. 8 sperm whales bob off our port side, half submerged in the cobalt Caribbean. They are gunmetal gray and smooth and cylindrical as airplane fuselages. The whales are taking a breather, literally. They've just surfaced to draw oxygen deep into their enormous squared-off heads. Soon they'll dive and use some of that air to converse. We're aboard Balena, a 40-foot sailboat swaying offshore of the West Indies island nation of Dominica. The tiny country rain-soaked peaks, now shrouded in mist, are partly why we're here. Those small green mountains block gales and keep deep leeward waters calm, ideal conditions for studying sperm whales. Ngero, crisscrossing the deck barefoot in board shorts, has studied more than sperm and whale families up close than perhaps any human in history. Since 2005, the adjunct professor at Denmark's Aarhus University and Canada's Carleton and Dalhousie Universities has come to this glittering swirl of sargassum and spray to study these leviathans. Rather than finding a monomaniac incarnation of malicious agencies, as Herman Melville described the sperm whale in Moby Dick, Garrow sees peaceful, playful animals. He can identify dozens on sight. There's Can Opener, who toys with researchers pulling close to their vessel before rolling sideways to eyeball Garrow's crew. There's Digit, who almost perished after swimming through fishing gear that lassoed her tail, nearly amputating it while preventing her from diving to eat. She's since healed. The one with the serrated fluke is called Knife. The one with the weird scoop in his was Spoon. The whales he knows are local island specialists, Garrow tells me. He follows them as they move through the underwater canyons off Dominica, between the islands of Guadalupe and Martinique. He has tracked them in sleeping, giving birth, and nursing, and making their first dives, playing with cousins, and dying. He's recorded them swimming deeper than most submarines travel. He knows their lives so intimately his kids at home can recite their names. But today, after more than a week at sea, we woke to find the locals gone, replaced by the eight outsiders riding swells around us. Garrow is gregarious by nature, yet this is the most excited I've seen him. He's shouting for students to drop underwater recorders called hydrophones. He warns them to get their cameras ready to photograph flukes, which, like fingerprints, help identify individual whales as they dive. These new whales are animals he barely knows, itinerant vagabonds from a second whale community. They occasionally share space with the regulars, but never interact with them. To me, they're sleek and glorious, but not so different from the local whales we spotted yesterday. To Garrow, they are unmistakable evidence that Dominica is home to parallel whale traditions, two cultures as divergent as farmers and nomadic hunter-gatherers. The roots of this knowledge come from the manned helming our sailboat, Garrow's mentor, Hal Whitehead. Curly-mopped, hat-brimmed, blown skyward by the wind, the professor at Dalhousie University studies our craft with one eye on our visitors. Sperm whales travel in lifelong female social units. Males are squeezed out by the early teens of about a dozen. In the 1980s and 90s, Whitehead tracked some of these social units across the Galapagos, partly as an excuse to live at sea. Then I just became really interested in them, he says. He and Luke Rendell, a researcher at the University of St. Andrews, started unspooling their cultural mysteries by documenting patterns of sperm whale chatter. Sperm whales use the world's largest brains to operate nature's largest sonar system. They send pressurized air through their snout, creating clicking sounds. They string these clicks together in rhythmic codas, rather like Morse code. Each coda lasts seconds or less. Some are three clicks, some may be a dozen or more. Over decades, Whitehead recorded clicks by the thousands. He had no clue what the whales were saying, but one day in his lab in Nova Scotia, Whitehead created a chart summarizing recording data from all these whale groups. He spotted a trend, roughly half made a common repertoire of calls. Their codas had similar patterns. Other units used different arrangements. I was blown away, Whitehead recalls. He bounded up concrete steps to Rendell's office. Rendell got it, too. These small whale units were part of something bigger. Whale clans of hundreds of thousands, and each clan was speaking its own dialect. Why would these animals, many of which had never met, have shared common calls? It's a group moniker, the men theorized, a way to say, I'm one of you. They knew small groups spent time with others in their clan, but never with outsiders. And in the inky black of the sea, sound is how they'd see who was around. Whitehead suspected click codas were similar to human markers of cultural identity. Think, he says, of the gear worn by English Premier League soccer fans. The Manchester United supporters parade around with a red scarf, the Manchester City with a blue scarf, Whitehead tells me as dust settles over the Caribbean. They don't all know each other and don't mingle, yet fans find their way to the pubs to watch matches together. It suggests this higher-level thing that's really important to the whales, Whitehead says. Over time, he, Rendell, and others also documented the whales in two distinct clans in the Galapagos that had startlingly different habits. In one, whales cruised the sea in meandering formations, while in the other, they swam in straighter lines. One clan stayed close to land, the other moved farther offshore. During El Niño periods, when waters swarmed, whales in both clans struggled to get enough food, but one clan had a harder time than the other. For whales, it appears there is this boundary between us who learn from each other and to do things one way, Garrow explains, and those who don't learn from us and do things differently. The idea that whales have cultures at all, let alone that they segregate themselves into cultural groups as humans do, was controversial when Whitehead and Rendell presented it in 2001. It is sad to see such rich empirical material about such wonderful creatures harnessed to such an impoverished theoretical agenda, one British anthropologist sneered. 20 years later, some skepticism remains. I would never say that sperm or killer whales do not have culture, but I would say the evidence for culture is stronger in many other animal species, such as humpbacks and songbirds, says Peter Tyack, a scientist with Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, who studies cetacean communication. Genetics, animal development, and the environment can work in complex ways that make it hard to definitely link behavior to culture. It is essential for scientists to be honest and humble about how little we know about the cultures of any animal species, he says. And yet whale scientists increasingly embrace Whitehead's view, says Sarah Mesnick, with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. It's gaining acceptance because more and more people are observing it, she says. Garrow, for example, found similar divisions among sperm whale clans in an entirely different sea than his mentor, the Caribbean. And Garrow's ability to drill down into life with individual whales has strengthened Whitehead's case. One afternoon, we spot a female sperm whale named Rounder. She's floating at the surface with two calves, only one of which is hers. Baby whales don't dive deep for squid, Garrow explained, so an adult protector stays outside as the unit hunts. We're watching Rounder babysit. Every unit does this differently. Some let the young slip beneath their bellies to suckle. In some units, calves get watched by non-relatives but get milk only from mom. In Rounder's group, moms and grandmothers share babysitting and nursing duties, but only for calves in their bloodline. In another, one female plays wet nurse to two calves at once, even though neither is hers. Garrow also discovered that small units within clans appear to emit family-specific codas, almost like submarines, while individuals communicate in click patterns with subtle signature variations, like first names. Using nothing but clicks, Garrow can tell which whale in a unit is speaking about 80% of the time, way better than random chance, he says. Garrow even recorded baby sperm whales making random clicks before winnowing their repertoire. They were zeroing in on their clan's dialect, like infants babbling before saying, Mama. They were acquiring cultural norms before him in real time. And we're going to pause there for part one of our journey into the secrets of whales from the May 2021 issue of National Geographic. Next week, we'll dive into part two on Armchair Travelers. I hope you'll be with us for that. Now, included with the article was a little more information about this business of whale songs being decoded, and I thought you might enjoy hearing a little bit more about how in the world do they communicate. And we have the introduction to this little article that accompanies the main article. Yaps and fin slaps, growls and groans. Whales use a wide range of sounds to communicate, but only five whale species are known to sing, with humpbacks the unrivaled musical masters of the sea. As juveniles, male humpbacks start picking up songs in bits and segments, listening to their peers in a form of social learning. Females vocalize but don't sing. Once they master a song, it changes slightly, eventually completely, as the population rearranges the tunes over days, weeks, and years. Songs have a complex structure similar to the repetition and rhymes of poetry, and all the males from the same ocean basin sing the same tune until it is modified yet again. This song, recorded and translated into human music by composer David Rothenberg, is one from a humpback repeatedly singing one song off the coast of Maui, Hawaii. Now, the shape of this sound is described here. It says humpback songs can be heard by the human ear, but their pace is slower than ours, making it hard to recognize melody. Researchers first identified their songs by printing out recorded spectrograms, which show pitch and timing. Visualized as shapes, song patterns emerged. Here, we're translated a whale song into both shapes and human musical score, and the notes that are presented are the first segment of the whale song, and below they show the same segment represented as a spectrograph, which also has color coding, and it's translated into a visual shape of sound, and this is to capture the pitch and timing. Now, the colors distinguish shapes and make patterns easier to recognize. In other words, the same colors, the same sound. Now, the simplified colored musical units are joined into longer patterns to form phrases, and which are then connected to construct themes. The themes are similar to individual lines of poetry or words of a song. And a song is considered a sequence of themes labeled, for example, A through F in their example. Humpback whale songs typically span 5 to 30 minutes. A whale may repeat a song many times during a marathon sketches that can last up to 22 hours, and experts call these marathons song sessions. Well, how far songs can travel? Well, five whales, blue, bowhead fin, humpback, and mink, are thought to sing. Smaller whales typically produce higher frequency signals, while massive blue and fin whales can sing at pitches too low for humans to hear. Low tones can travel farthest, but each is affected by natural ocean sounds, such as waves, and human-caused noise pollution, such as shipping. Sound travels roughly four times as fast as water is in the air. So there's some additional information about the importance of those whale songs. By the way, before we close out today, we found in the June 13, 2021 issue of the News and Observer a headline that said, "How many oceans does the Earth have?" The latest answer is five, and this was written by Paulina Ferozzi of the Washington Post, and we're going to read part of this in our remaining moment. For the first time in more than 100 years that National Geographic Society has mapped the world's oceans, it will recognize five oceans. The organization announced this week that it will recognize the Southern Ocean, a body of water that encircles Antarctica, as the world's fifth. Scientists have long known there's a distinct ecological region around Antarctica. National Geographic Society geographer Alex Tate said in an interview, "But at least in the international scientific community, there hasn't always been complete agreement on the name and boundary of this body of water." National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, officials said the federal agency recognized the body as the fifth ocean in 1999 when the U.S. Board and Geographic Names approved the Southern Ocean. When the board boundaries of the ocean were proposed in 2000 to the International Hydrographic Organization, IHO, which tracks and charts the world's seas and oceans, not all IHO member countries were in agreement, according to NOAA. Tate said that while National Geographic has labeled the ocean on its maps before, it came with a disclaimer about the lack of broad agreement. So some further information as we continue to dive into the world of oceans, and we'll continue that next week. Thank you for listening to this week's edition of Armchair Traveler. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, reminding you the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler, available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments and questions can be directed to 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.